Next up is somebody who was a real find. He actually emailed me, and I'm really pleased that he did. Dave O'Brien has been featured recently on a number of broadcasts, programs like Ted Wallachian's program in Canada, talking about his book to do with the JFK assassination, and of course now brought into great focus by the release of those 2,800 documents just days ago, authorized by Donald J. Trump. That have been kept secret. There are still 300 documents that are not released, but there is some kind of campaign to get them out there. Now, whether they shed any new light on it all has yet to be determined. But Dave O'Brien has written a book called The View from the Oswald Window. He's actually been to the site of that heinous crime and has done a lot of intensive research. He is based in Canada, and he was very, very well worth speaking to, as you will hear. To us, if you're a regular on this show, the idea that Lee Harvey Oswald actually was assisted in some way won't be at all new. The question that will reverberate down the decades is, who else and what else was involved? And that is where we're at today with the release of these files. I think you know my take on all of this. My view of it is, after 13, 14 years of doing this, if there had been some kind of high-level conspiracy, and there is every chance that there may have been. Who was involved? We can talk about that until those cows come home. But if there had been that kind of thing, do you really honestly think it would be documented and filed away for people to find in later years? It's almost like a burglar submitting a tax return. You know, on the 13th of April, I broke into 57 Cheveley Rise, and I stole a television set, a fridge, and a microwave oven. Total value, £570. No, of course not. Similarly, if there was that kind of thing happening here in 1963, do you think it would have been officially documented? Now, there may be a paper trail leading back that may cause us to have our own concerns and suppositions about all of this. That's another thing. So, do these 2,800 documents take us any nearer knowing any more, is the big question. My personal view is, I'm not sure. But I want to get on now a man who's written a brand new book. He's in Canada tonight, and his name is Dave O'Brien. The book is looking at things from the perspective of that window in the Texas Book Depository, where Lee Harvey Oswald supposedly fired off those shots in rapid succession and took the life of a man who had a lot of years left in him to innovate and make policy, John Fitzgerald Kennedy. Dave O'Brien in Canada, thank you very much for coming on The Unexplained tonight.
My pleasure, Howard.
And also, Dave, for listening to all of that. Please, if you disagreed with anything I said there, take me up on it right now.
Actually, I don't. And in fact, I wholeheartedly agree with one thing that you said, and that in my opinion as well, a lot of files that will never be released because they were destroyed before they ever could be released. And so I think that you're right on. And the documents that were released were really there was no earth-shattering documents that came out of it. But from my perspective and my own book, the thing that I was very happy about was there are now confirmed documents, FBI, CIA documents, establishing that there was a CIA mafia alliance that was involved in political assassinations, especially Fidel Castro. And I think that that is the boiling point over how John Kennedy ended up dead.
When you say the boiling point, how do you mean?
Well, I think everything centers around early 60s Cuba. You had the Bay of Pigs invasion, and it's well known now through these documents that the CIA was training anti-Castro Cubans for the Bay of Pigs invasion, as well as assassination attempts against Fidel Castro that failed. And after the Bay of Pigs itself failed in 1961, that we then had the Cuban Missile Crisis. And that was a peaceful resolve, as you know, and President Kennedy vowed never to invade Cuba. And after that, I believe that the target switched from Fidel Castro to John Kennedy. And it did so because the CIA was angry at him for the lack of air cover at the Bay of Pigs, and the organized crime that they were involved with as well. They wanted to, they funded the Bay of Pigs invasion, and they wanted to get back into Havana, where they used to own the casino operations under President Batista. And when he was deposed, Castro took over the casinos, nationalized them. He imprisoned Santo Trafficante, the crime boss from Florida, and he ousted Mayor Lansky and other crime bosses. And they linked up with the CIA because they wanted to get their casinos back. That was a lot of money to them, and that's why Kennedy was targeted.
But we can only make an informed guess about this. I have heard, I mean, what you've just said is one of a whole number of theories about this. One of which, of course, and only one, is that Lee Harvey Oswald, who had his own sympathies, who had lived in Moscow, who had a Russian wife, acted entirely alone.
Yes, and I believe the evidence is now overwhelming that this did not happen. Oswald has now been shown to have CIA contacts through a fellow by the name of David Ferry in Louisiana. They go back to 1955, if not earlier, in the Civil Air Patrol, where David Ferry was an instructor. And Oswald, we have pictures of Oswald and Ferry together. And David Ferry is a very well-known both CIA and organized crime fellow. He worked for Louisiana crime boss Carlos Marcello during his deportation hearings. He was a private pilot, and it's believed that when Marcello was deported from the United States to Guatemala, it was David Ferry who flew him back in months later. And so you've got Ferry connected with Marcello and the CIA. And also, one of these files also involved an FBI tape, a tap of Carlos Marcello, who actually confessed to the murder of President Kennedy on these taps.
And what about this man Ferry? Is he still alive?
No, he died during the Jim Garrison investigation. He was going to be called as a witness, and Garrison was pondering the possibility of also charging him with complicity. But no, he died of apparent heart attack during the Jim Garrison investigation.
Of course, there were other people who died around this, weren't there? There were people who died in the years subsequent to the death of John F. Kennedy, people who might have known stuff.
Over 100 people died in the 10 years following the assassination, which is astronomical in the odds of that happening. And the most famous name that perhaps your listeners may be aware of is Dorothy Kilgallen. She was not only a respected reporter for a New York publication, but she was on the popular TV show What's My Line. Well, she was the only person, Howard, to get an exclusive interview with Jack Ruby while he was awaiting a retrial.
Now, we have to explain, and this will come up also in an interview that we're going to run at the back end of this hour with Governor Jesse Ventura, who has also investigated these things, who you may well be aware of. But Dorothy Kilgallen, for people who don't know in this country, and it is something that hasn't had a lot of coverage in the UK, she will be better known in the US. She was a very successful journalist. She was so successful that she was on a TV panel game. That's how successful she was on a regular basis. Very intelligent woman, very high profile. And you tell me if I'm wrong in the bones of this, but she was going to come out with something about the death of JFK, and then suddenly a woman at the peak of her powers, with no reason to commit suicide, is found dead in circumstances that suggest that that's what she did.
That's absolutely correct. She emerged from that interview with Jack Ruby, and the only thing she would say was that what Jack Ruby told me will shatter the world. And of course, she said nothing else because she wanted to write about it and have the scoop of a lifetime. Less than 2 weeks later, Howard, she was found dead in her apartment from alcohol and barbiturate poisoning. She wasn't a drinker. Her friends call it mysterious, for sure. She just had the exclusive of a lifetime. There was no reason to take her own life. She, her notes from that interview with Jack Ruby were never found. And a close personal friend of Dorothy Kilgallen's was also found dead from a karate chop to her neck less than 10 days after Dorothy Kilgallen died. So it's unsolved. But I can report to you that... The New York District Attorney, present day, Cyrus Vance, has just announced that the Dorothy Kilgallen murder, as he calls it now, based on new information, has now been reopened. So we may hear more information down the road.
Mm. But of course, if we do, that path will lead back to some very unpleasant material, possibly linked to the subject about which we're talking now, JFK.
Exactly. And also, by the way, Dorothy Kilgallen was the person who was writing a book at the time of her death that was going to expose the secret or the sex affairs of President Kennedy, including Marilyn Monroe and including a German spy that she had divulged in a couple of reports in the newspaper, as well as a lady that you may be familiar with as well, Judith Campbell Exner, who not only was sleeping with President Kennedy, was also sleeping with Sam Giancana, the Chicago crime boss, who I believe was involved in the assassination as well.
It's a deep and dirty business. And the connections within these spirals of plotting and the machinations of it are they would have happened at a deeply subterranean level, wouldn't they? They'd have been deeply, deeply secret.
For sure. And the documents reveal some really fascinating things. They reveal that... that they were more concerned, the FBI and the CIA were more concerned with their own failings pertaining to Oswald than to finding any evidence that would suggest that there might have been a conspiracy of sorts. So both had interests to make sure that it was just Oswald and to sweep everything else under the carpet. And that was evident from day one. And now the documents that have come out are showing that.
And when you say their own failings as regards Lee Harvey Oswald, in the next segment of our conversation, I want to talk more about him and your visit to the Texas Book Depository where the shots were fired from. But we'll do that in the next segment. What failings would they have made? You mean that they didn't make it more clear that, or that they didn't draw the finger of suspicion more clearly towards him? In other words, they left room for doubt.
Well, as far as the FBI goes, to give you an example, the FBI was aware and had Oswald under surveillance. And just a matter of weeks before the assassination, they had interviewed Marina Oswald, his wife. Lee Oswald was very angry about that, and he walked into the FBI office where this agent, James Hostey, was stationed, and he wasn't there. So he left a threatening note for the FBI to leave his wife alone in particular. And when the assassination occurred, Hostey, instead of filing it and submitting it to the Warren Commission, destroyed it. So he destroyed evidence pertinent to the assassination. What's really interesting about the whole thing is that the FBI knew that Oswald worked at the Book Depository building. And even though 3 days before the visit, the map was published in the papers that showed the motorcade would pass through or by the Oswald window in the Book Depository window, in the Book Depository building, the FBI did absolutely nothing to put Oswald under surveillance and do anything. I mean, that's just a red flag.
So is that, I mean, we have heard a lot of talk about the CIA being involved, that other armature of security in the U.S., the CIA being... complicit in some way, it is claimed in this, but the FBI complicit in that, although they may not have actually been part of the plot, they knew about it and they didn't do anything about it.
They knew it. They knew that they failed to surveil Oswald correctly, and they certainly participated in the cover-up aspect of the assassination for sure, and that was to cover their butt more than anything.
Hmm. And all these years down the track, we're never going to be able to, you are never going to be able to stand any of this up and absolutely prove it, are you, 100%?
No, you're right, Howard, but I think these documents are encouraging. They show that there was some sinister stuff going on between the CIA and organized crime and the mafia. They show the failings of the intelligence agencies involved in protecting the president of the United States, as well as investigating it afterward. And so the Warren Commission, I feel bad for the Warren Commission. I used to criticize them like crazy, but they were completely kept in the dark on so many of these documents that have come out now. I bet that 9 out of 10 documents that would just came out, the Warren Commission never saw.
Okay, Dave, I want to talk now about Lee Harvey Oswald, this man who is said to have done it all by himself and who history and the belief of American people shows that he may well not have been acting alone, you know, and it is disingenuous to suggest that that he was, perhaps. So, talk to me about Lee Harvey Oswald.
Well, he definitely is a character that is more sinister and more accomplished in the intelligence community and in the underground of anti-Castro movements and stuff like that than we are led to believe. So I believe, where I break with many of my conspiracy theorist colleagues, I believe that Oswald was involved in the assassination. Mm-hmm. I just don't think he was one of the assassins that fired that day in Dealey Plaza. I think his job, Howard, was to simply get the sixth floor window ready for the actual assassin, which, because he worked in the building and he had access to the window and he could do that. What he didn't know was that his weapon was going to be brought into the building and set up, and pre-fired shells were going to be left behind, and they would all lead back to Lee Harvey Oswald as the sole assassin of President Kennedy.
So you're saying that this man was recruited, and we can get into by whom, to be a facilitator, to make sure that the scene was set, the place where this would happen was readied, and then the person who actually did this would be able to exit the building with stealth and ease.
Yes, I believe that he was part of a plot to assassinate the president. One of the points that I make in the book is that window that he chose is a terrible choice if there was a lone assassin involved here. But there wasn't a lone assassin. There were two other assassins at play, and that became evident when I went to the window, because if I was a lone assassin, that was the worst possible sniper's nest you could possibly have. There was even a better location for a sniper, a lone assassin sniper, in the same building on the same floor. How they chose that window is beyond me. I just don't believe that it made any sense whatsoever to use that window.
That is bizarre, isn't it? If there was a better location, if you were going to do this, and you were going to do this effectively, then you would find somewhere else, unless you wanted to leave questions open subsequently, unless you wanted to add an air of mystery and indecision and this veil of fog that we've had over the case for all of these years.
Well, if I may, Howard, the thing that's really stands out when you are, if you are at the window itself.
And we've got to say that you got access to the window of the Texas Book Depository at a time when they were not letting people in.
Correct.
Okay, and just before we get into that, how did it feel to be there and stand there and know what had happened there?
Well, it was, to say eerie is undermines it. I don't know how many of your listeners have ever been to Dealey Plaza, Howard, but I'm assuming there's quite a few, actually. And there's an X on the road on Elm Street, and that's the exact location where the president's life ended, based on the headshot. And so if you're in Dealey Plaza and you look at the X on the road, that's a very eerie feeling. I took it a step above that. I was allowed into the building. I went up to the so-called Oswald window, where we know at least two shots came from. And to stand at that window, knowing that history occurred, even though I was just pretending to be the assassin at the window, my hands were sweaty. Mm-hmm. I was nervous. It was just a terrible feeling, really, just terrible. And the only thing that was overwhelming after that was the observations I made that made it absolutely ridiculous that one person could have shot all three shots from that window and then made a successful escape. Whereas if the other alternative was used, as I indicate in the book, the escape becomes much easier.
Hmm. But it's still not an ideal location for what happened, and further adding fuel to the fire that says that bullets fired from that window could not have done that amount of damage and been that effective. There had to be other bullets coming from somewhere else.
There had to be. To give you an example, Howard, if you're looking at the window, straight out the window, you're looking onto Houston Street. And so the limousine for a short time was approaching Oswald or whoever that assassin was in the window. I don't think it was Oswald. It was approaching him. The assassin allowed rather than take that much easier shot, the assassin allowed the president's motorcade to make a left-hand turn immediately below him and begin to move away from him on Elm Street before he began the shooting. And therein brings the second problem, and that's the oak tree. The oak tree on Elm Street, there's a picture that I took from the window. It's on my website, and it's in my book, and it shows that the assassin from that window could not have begun firing at the president until, obviously, Mr. Kennedy had cleared the foliage of the tree. The problem is that between the clearing of the tree and the overpass just ahead, it was a very short distance, minimizing his firing time. And I believe that that still took place, that scenario still took place, because I believe the assassin at that window had to allow the limousine to make a left-hand turn so the president could enter the trap for what I call a triangulation of crossfire so that two other assassins could participate in shooting the president.
Hmm. But if you were wanting to pin it all on Lee Harvey Oswald, who said, "I'm a patsy," then you would have given him a better location, wouldn't you?
I would have, for sure. And that's it. It just wasn't thought out. And I think it wasn't thought out because it wasn't a lone assassin. This wasn't ever carried out from the perspective of a lone assassin. It was carried out from the perspective that there were three assassins, and each of them had to have an opportunity to fire at the president in order to guarantee a very successful assassination.
But if it was such a professional job and there was a kind of jackal type character in the Texas Book Depository who was going to take shots at the president, and those shots would be augmented by other shots that would, you know, would hit the president from somewhere else, and that's a trap that his motorcade would have gone into automatically, wouldn't a professional hit person have said, "This is a lousy location. I am not going to take the risk of doing this here because it's not going to work and we might get caught"?
Absolutely, Howard. I mean, look at it this way. I was a 27-year-old journalist when I was at the window, and it took me literally under 2 minutes at that location to say, "Wait a minute, this is terribly wrong." Even as I was approaching the window, even before I got there, the vibes weren't right. I looked at the window, and I noticed immediately, and you'll see that on the website or in my book, in order for me to fire out the window, I had to either kneel or crouch. I couldn't stand there and fire like Wyatt Earp. That would have been ridiculous. I couldn't steady myself in any way, shape, or form. I had to, if I was the lone assassin, it was a very unsteady position in which to carry out a very precise assassination. It just didn't make sense. As I was walking to the window, and then when I got to the window, it told me that this whole scenario is ridiculous when it comes to one assassin and nobody else.
So Oswald was there as a facilitator, and he thought that he was going to walk out of that building and say, "What a terrible thing has happened here today," and he would just, you know, be talked to by the security services, as everybody was on that day, and he would be allowed to go free. Is that what we believe?
Yes, 100%. And I think what happened, if I may, is that, because I did a test in the book depository. You may know, Howard, that 90 seconds after the assassination, Oswald was seen on the second floor lunchroom of the building. Mm-hmm. He was confronted by a Dallas police officer, Marion Baker, 90 seconds after the assassination. Baker observed Oswald, had a gun pointed at him, said that he was totally calm and relaxed. The escort that the officer had said, "Oh, he works here. He had a right to be here." And off they went to find somebody of suspicion. But it wasn't Oswald. So I did my own test when I was there. I took the stairs as Oswald did, and I could get to the second floor lunchroom in 90 seconds. But when I got there, I was out of breath. I was clammy. I was slightly perspiring. And if then, if I turned around and there was a policeman with a gun at my head, and I had just shot the President of the United States, I don't think I would be calm in any way, shape, or form as Oswald was. And so that's, and so what happened was, I believe, Oswald was in the second floor lunchroom. He had set up the window just as he thought. But there was such a convergence on the Book Depository building by police within seconds of the assassination. It made him nervous. And he just left the building hurriedly. He went home, got a gun. And then the rest is also history.
So he realized this hasn't gone as we thought it was going to go. Somebody told him, you'll play your role and then you'll be in the clear. And that's why he was seen apparently calm very soon after this happened. And you know, I can't imagine anybody who would commit an act like that unless they were completely brainwashed and completely almost a Manchurian candidate. Unless that's what they were, then they wouldn't be as calm as he appeared in that situation when he was questioned immediately or seen immediately after. It's astonishing. One of the things that appeared on the front page of at least one of our newspapers yesterday, Dave, is that according to these newly released papers, they show that Oswald went to Mexico City for talks with a Russian assassination chief. What's that all about? Do you know?
Well, I don't think that there's much to it. I think that Oswald was simply trying to get back to the Soviet Union, and he was trying to do that by speaking to someone at the Soviet embassy in Mexico City directly. And when that didn't go well, he then went to the Cuban embassy in Mexico City, hoping to get a visa to the Soviet Union via Cuba. So as far as the talking to the assassinations expert from the Soviet Union, I think that's just the person that he ended up speaking to because he was stationed in Mexico City at the time. And but that is by no coincidence, Howard, the documents that are still to be released now, April 26th of 2018. And I think we'll learn a lot more about what Oswald did at the embassies in Mexico City and whether or not it was just him trying to get back to the Soviet Union or whether there was something more involved remains to be seen. At this point, we don't know.
Why was Oswald impersonated? Why were there people or a person sent out to look like him?
Well, I think, Howard, if Oswald was set up as the guy that he was obviously told to set up the window, and then his rifle was brought in, so it was clear from the outset that he was going to be set up as the sole assassin. And part of that strategy is to make sure that he does rather unorthodox things in the days and the weeks prior to the assassination to leave so-called fingerprints around that the man was capable of violence or had a temper or, you know, this or that. And so, yes, there are all kinds of reports about a second Oswald, including a man in Mexico City that went in and posed as Oswald. And that means that there was two trips. Well, one was actually Oswald, as we now know, but there was also a second man that went in posing as Oswald in Mexico City. But there were other things closer to the Dallas area that in which they tried to frame Oswald. And of course, you might also remember he took a shot at General Walker, and that was also brought into evidence to show that he had the capacity for violence, and therefore he could have been the assassin of President Kennedy. The problem there is, of course, was that General Walker was sitting in his study at home, and Oswald missed him with a single shot, and so he couldn't even hit a stationary man with a single shot. But we are expected to believe that he could have shot a moving target three times in 5.6 seconds. The whole thing is absurd.
What about the idea that's come out in the newspapers here? And you know, I dimly remember hearing somebody say this a long time ago, but it's not something that's been hugely prominent. The idea that the Dallas Police Department itself was in some way complicit. That stretches credulity a long way. What's your take on that thought?
Well, I think if there is any involvement by the Dallas Police Department, I think it's in the aftermath. Jack Ruby, we now know, knew up to 80% of all Dallas police officers, because
now we have to say that Jack Ruby, just for people who may be very young, haven't read into this, was the man who subsequently shot Lee Harvey Oswald before he could stand trial. He just stepped forward. Oswald was being brought out in front of television cameras, very famous footage, gunned him down. And Jack Ruby was a nightclub owner, wasn't he, who was very well connected in Dallas.
Yes, and he also was an organized crime figure. Just so you know, and the documents that have been released, it seemed to indicate that as well. But where the Dallas Police Department comes into suspicion is the fact that they couldn't protect Oswald in their custody, despite the fact that they received all kinds of death threats against Oswald.
They couldn't protect him, or they didn't want to.
Well, there's the question, Howard. There's no evidence to suggest they didn't want to, but certainly their actions afterwards leave a lot to be desired. And of course, we have the belief that because Ruby knew all kinds of officers at the Dallas Police Department, that they helped him get into the basement of the Dallas jail at the precise moment that Oswald was being transferred, because at that morning, all newsmen and the TV stations that were carrying it live were told to be at the Dallas basement at 10 a.m. Well, the transfer was delayed by quite a while, but there was no Ruby at 10 a.m. But at 11:17 a.m., Ruby does his business outside across the street. He walks into the basement of the Dallas jail. He had to have walked past at least two Dallas police officers. And he took his position, and within 30 seconds later, Oswald is paraded out, Ruby shoots him, and the conspiracy or the cover-up begins. So that comes to the failings of the Dallas Police Department and Ruby's ability to somehow know, and the only person in America who knew exactly when Oswald would be transferred from in the Dallas basement.
So you think that Jack Ruby was very much more than the patriot that he was initially, the misguided patriot that he was portrayed to be immediately after the killing, a man who was so enraged by the killing of the president that he had to take out the man who did it?
It was nonsense. He said that he wanted to spare Mrs. Kennedy the ordeal of returning to Dallas for a trial. But in the papers, newspapers found in his apartment after he was taken into custody, there was an article in the Dallas Morning News that he had circled that said that Mrs. Kennedy would not have to return to Dallas, that she could just file a deposition, and that was good enough for the court. And so Ruby, I believe, was involved with organized crime. And when Oswald survived and was not taken out, perhaps by Dallas police officer J.D. Tippit, but we don't know, Ruby was then brought in to assassinate Oswald and silence him. And we now know through police records that have been released in documents that Jack Ruby made an incredible amount of phone calls to organized crime types of individuals that he was associated with in the weeks leading up to the assassination. And so we know that there's a link there.
But if this was such a plot, a well-engineered plot, we've already heard actually that there were holes in it at the Texas Book Depository. But if it was a plot that had been put together by professionals, why would they need to be worried about what Lee Harvey Oswald might say? Because he'd been so stitched up, if you believe that he had been, as we say here in the UK, that anything that he said wouldn't be accepted.
Well, certainly there would have been skepticism right from moment one. But I think that he could not have been allowed to live to stand trial. Because had he been alive for a trial, then a lot of the evidence that ended up suppressed by the Warren Commission and by the FBI and the CIA would have come out at a trial. And under skilled cross-examination by defense attorneys, if Oswald had those, I think a lot more information would have come out that indicated that he may have been involved, and I believe he was, but that he wasn't by himself. And that just simply could not be allowed to come to the public domain.
So actually, if you buy the idea that this was some kind of cabal of people who got together to take out the president at a quite high level, and there were people of importance involved in this, they didn't do it very well, did they?
Well, they didn't do it very well, but I can tell you something. They did it with the knowledge that President Johnson would lock up files about the assassination for 75 years, and that we weren't supposed to know the truth until 2038. And so this is where I give a little bit of leeway to the Warren Commission. They were denied all kinds of information from the FBI and CIA, which is now coming out in this in these files that have been released. But everything that they dealt with was under the premise that nobody would see anything until 2038. And therefore, just so you know, the film, the Zapruder film, was never seen for 12 years until 1975. So nobody ever saw what happened after the fatal headshot.
Where was the Zapruder film kept, by the way? Just remind me where it was kept, because it wasn't kept where you would have thought. This is the famous color film. It's the only film of the assassination that exists taken by Mr. Zapruder. Where was that held until it was released?
It was held by the Life magazine.
Exactly.
They bought the rights to it. And when they, by the way, when they published stills of the film, of the assassination, because they own the rights, they never showed anything beyond frame 312, which is the fatal headshot. And so they were part of it. So nobody knew for 12 years that the president's head moved violently backward. And then when the Warren report comes out saying that Oswald fired all shots from behind, there was no evidence or reason to believe that that wasn't the case.
Tell me if I'm right about this, because I only realized this today, that the Warren Commission didn't actually use photographs of Kennedy's head. They actually used sketches that were taken from those photographs. So they never actually saw or considered the actual photographs of the damage done to his head. Am I right there?
You're absolutely 100% right. Instead of photographs and x-rays of the president, the Warren Commission decided that it was in a better taste to provide artistic schematic drawings of the wounds. And I can understand that, because I've seen some of the actual photographs and x-rays.
But equally, look, as a reporter, and you've probably had to do this as a journalist too, I had to attend murder trials, and I have seen the photographs that members of the jury were shown in one particular case, and they were sick-makingly, stomach-turningly awful. In this case, you would have thought they would see the photographs and they wouldn't have those reservations about taste. But this is just one of so many things, Dave, that will be talked about, I think, for another 50 years. Sum up for me just finally, would you, before I let you plug the book, of course, who you believe then now at this distance of time, knowing that there will be people who say this is just absurd to think that anybody other than the lone gunman did it, but who do you believe did this? What was the cabal made up of?
I believe the cabal was made up of rebel elements of the CIA, which is to say that it wasn't an organized CIA plot. Rebel elements, namely E. Howard Hunt and Frank Sturgis, these two individuals were involved in training anti-Castro Cubans for the Bay of Pigs invasion, as well as they were involved in assassination attempts against Fidel Castro, and they did that in alliance with three specific members of organized crime, all heads of families. That was Santos Traficante in Florida, it was Sam Giancana of Chicago, and Carlos Marcello of Louisiana. Those three individuals wanted to get back at Kennedy because Kennedy had betrayed them by Bobby Kennedy putting all kinds of pressure on them and in the Justice Department after they helped Kennedy get elected. And I think that alliance, in which we can now tie in Oswald and Ruby to both the CIA and organized crime, I think that's the cabal that ended up killing President Kennedy on November 22nd, 1963.
And the FBI helped along the way, you think, by making sure that there were many clouds over this and a lot of obfuscation that we never really got to hear very much more than we have heard, you think?
Yes, they were definitely the chief investigative arm of the Warren Commission. And so in essence, they were responsible for a lot of failed information, withheld information, misinformation that was passed along to the Warren Commission. And for years, they are the ones, more than anyone, who has been responsible for the cover-up.
Dave O'Brien, thank you for doing this. Last question for you. Why did you want to do this?
I wanted to do it because at the age of 13, I was able to get my hands on all the Warren Commission volumes, all 26 plus the summary edition, and I read it. It took me 18 months to read it, and I could see at my age, 13 and 14, that there were omissions, there were contradictions, there were just mistakes like crazy. It got me into writing to people, and to my astonishment, a couple of people wrote back, like Dr. Malcolm Perry, who was the first doctor to see the president. And from there, it just became a hobby, and it grew from there, and it's never stopped. I just have an appetite for it, and now, of course, with the documents released, it's all back in the news, and I just thought it's time to write my book.
How's it doing?
It's doing very well so far. I'm pleased to report.
All right,
even making some sales in the UK.
Well, I think you might make a few more after tonight. So tell us the title of the book and how you can get it.
The book is Through the Oswald Window. The book is available at my website, which is throughtheoswaldwindow.com, or it's also available on amazon.com.
Dave O'Brien, the book is called Through the Oswald Window, and I'm really pleased that we found him, and we will be hearing more from him. The subject of who killed John F. Kennedy and why that happened will reverberate down some more decades. I think it's already been 54 years, very nearly, since the assassination in Dallas, Texas, and there are almost as many theories as there are years that have passed. I wonder if we'll still be asking this question in 50 years from now. Maybe, maybe not. But we'll see what those remaining 300 documents, if they're ever released, have to tell us.